A founder comes along and says, hey, I want to build a partner program. Well, sure, of course you do. It makes perfect sense, right? You can scale it. It's variable cost. You don't have to, you know, manage the day-to-day of a sales team. And yes, theoretically, that's great. The first thing you want to do, there's two things that happen. They say, okay, let's go recruit. All right, we want to get partners in the door. And then they say, well, who do I know that can sell my product? Well, that's really the wrong question to ask. The right question is, who is my target customer and who is influencing them? Who already has their ear? That is your potential partner.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, it's Phil, and in this episode of Partnership Plus, we meet with Greg Plum, who is an ecosystem expert, a three-time TEDx speaker, and as it turns out, trained as a geophysicist. We're going to cover a range of topics that help you to start a partnership from a standing start, to invest in the relationship, and to also make it successful over the long term. This is a great conversation, which I know you'll love. So without further ado, let's meet with Greg Plum. Well, we are going to dive into a bunch of stuff today, and we've already introduced you before the episode started, but everyone, this is Greg Plum, three times TEDx speaker, trained as a geophysicist, has been in partnerships and business development and sales for a really long time, has seen so much stuff, and spends a lot of his time now teaching people how to think about partnerships in a way which is practical and can grow the pie for everyone. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. So, Greg, let's just start at the ground floor here because you have quite a remarkable story. What is the Greg Plum backstory?
I feel remarkable is a bit strong, Phil. I'll take it. I like it, but I think remarkable is a bit strong. It has not been a straight path. That much I will tell you. It has been very, very windy for sure. So I started out in geophysics. You said trained in geophysics. Yes, I was educated, and then I never ever practiced. I got into business right out of school. That's another whole side story. We need to go there. But 10 years in big corporation, decided big corporate wasn't for me. Loved it. It was great training ground, but I wanted to do something a little more entrepreneurial. Got into tech. Thank goodness I got into tech. And then discovered, you know, the concept of partnerships, kind of accidentally, and realized that my passion wasn't the tech itself. My passion was the distribution, by way of partnerships. And that's really kind of where I've dug in over the last 25 years.
And so when we think about where tech sort of started, I've spoken to a number of people about what it was like before all of these services were out there, where today all of our workflows, all of our lives are largely dictated by, you know, Teams and Slack and video conferencing like we have here and all of these other very complicated ecosystem players. When we go back to the very beginning of, you know, the web, back even further into, you know, the 1980s and 90s, when you think about how those partnerships started, what was the analog version of how partnerships were being done? Because back in the day for us, you know, for you and I, it was really build a relationship, see where the incentives might have been, and then use faxes to what was going on. So when we go back to that point, you know, what was the stomping ground like for partnerships in those early days?
So it's interesting. In my very first job was with a bank, and we built the business was built on affinity marketing. So it was a different type of partnership, but it was still a partnership nonetheless. You wouldn't have found it was MBNA. You would never see an MBNA commercial on television, on mass media, because MBNA, brilliant in their approach, much more niche, and they would go to have different association credit cards. So they would have American Dental Association credit card, National Education Association credit card, a Ducks Unlimited card. So they appealed to a narrow audience, and that's how they went to market. Truly partnerships, right? Just had a different name, but that's kind of my first exposure to it. And I didn't realize how unique it was and how it really set you apart from your competition when you do have that type of alliance. Fast forward to that my first tech, I got lucky, Phil. I took the phone call at the right time. You know, I was running, I was a sales guy. Somebody said something about, I was the only sales guy, it was a small company, this concept of partnerships. And I thought, wow, if I could find somebody to sell this stuff for me, this is a beautiful thing. I don't have to manage them, right? I just have to motivate them and get be a cheerleader and then collect the checks. It sounds great. Well, it's not quite that simple, as we both know. Yeah. But the concept of scalability and variable cost really appealed to me. And that's when I really dug in. Yes, it was much more manual. But it was also, thank goodness we have the tech we have now today, because it's gotten more complicated. You know, partnerships used to be very back and forth, right? Just a two-way interaction. Nowadays, there's the concept of ecosystem where it's more of a matrix, right? And there's so many different, right. It's a web of opportunity. Thank goodness we have the technology to be able to really track that attribute the right account partners to the accounts, just because it's gotten way more complex. More opportunity, more complex.
Yeah, I get that. And it's interesting as well because, you know, I spend time with a lot of, I guess, hubs in software as a service where they're the provider, there are multiple ecosystems coming off the back of their primary technology. And, you know, these companies, they're not coming and going quickly, but there's more entering the system. And so being able to work out who do you pick, who is the best strategic partner. And we think about, I use the term strategic partner, you know, we're thinking about multiple years, but the technology moves so quickly that it's difficult to allow a partnership to bed in to know whether it's going to work out well enough and place a bet. So there's a lot of multiple bet going on here. But I remember you saying and using this term resilient revenue. And I love that turn of phrase because it stayed with me because I think when a lot of people are trying to stabilize a business model, particularly when it's quite a new business and you've got to demonstrate that to so many stakeholders, or if you're a partnerships expert or specialist working inside a larger company and you're trying to demonstrate the net worth of that function, it is really important to try and make sure that you do have that resilient revenue stream. Tell me a little bit about how you think about the process. Now, you know, we've talked about the process that we think about here around ideal partnerships, but when you think about educating somebody on the ground floor of what it takes to build really fantastic, resilient, you know, thriving partnerships, where do you start with that? What's the ground zero for the way you educate?
Strategy. That's where I think most fall short. A founder comes along and says, hey, I want to build a partner program. Well, sure, of course you do. It makes perfect sense, right? You can scale it. It's variable cost. You don't have to, you know, manage the day-to-day of a sales team. And yes, theoretically, that's great. The first thing you want to do, there's two things that happen. They say, okay, let's go recruit. All right, we want to get partners in the door. And then they say, well, who do I know that can sell my product? Well, that's really the wrong question to ask. The right question is, who is my target customer and who is influencing them? Who already has their ear? That is your potential partner. And then once you have that, you know, it's around the creating the structure. And we talked, you know, a little bit in the past about, you know, my firm, Partnernomics. It's an advisory firm around partnerships. And it's a framework. What I love about this, you know, I've been in partnerships 25 years. I've seen lots of programs, more programs fail than succeed, quite frankly. But that's the norm. That's the norm in this space. And I think the overwhelming reason why they failed is because of a lack of structure. You know, the people do, they get involved, they get a deal comes in. Hey, this is cool. This partner brought this deal. Let's focus there. Oh, another one came over here. Let's go focus over there. Okay, let's calm down. Let's really do this the right way. Let's have a strategy in place. Let's have a framework, right? I say calm down. It's my wife always says to me, okay, calm down. The frame and the framework is the Partnernomics framework is first strategy. So where do you start? You start with strategy. You don't start with recruiting. If you do that, you're going to recruit the wrong partners. They're not going to be aligned. We may get to that discussion in a little bit here. Then you have recruiting. So strategy, then recruiting, then contracting, onboarding, enablement, huge, two huge pieces. It's a heavy upfront lift, but it pays dividends on the back end. Once you've enabled, then you've got the operations. Now you scale it. Now you put something in place that leads to that resilient revenue that sustains market fluctuations, competition coming and going. That's really what it's all about.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, we've also talked about this before, where there is this strange notion, and I guess it's strange to us, but it's probably very common. A deal has been done and everyone is celebrating the deal because so much work went into getting signatures on a page. And now we have the circumstance 6 to 8 months later where it's languishing, and then 12 months after that, if it even gets that far, it's sort of dead on arrival. And it's one of those things where I get very nervous when I hear when people call me and say, so it's just not working. And I would have to say 8 out of 10 times, it has been zero enablement. It's been all the effort into the deal, big hand wave, and then it's fallen flat. And when I spoke to Guy Kawasaki about this a few weeks ago, he made that exact point that any partnership worth its weight of anything has to force the people involved to boot Excel and work out exactly how it's going to change the cost of goods sold or the upside. And that thinking has to be done in order for there to be any chance of that being the case. And that goes to your strategy point. But when we think about the way that partnerships can play out, I don't think people often understand that there are those steps. So when you are talking about the exemplar, a great partnership that really helped put real meat on the bones for you to go, I love this partnership space. What was that one for you or two for you that really stays with you and you talk about it from the rooftops?
Yep. Well, first off, I think it's interesting that Guy Kawasaki was the opening act for me. So thank you for that. I love that. So I think I did have a partnership early in my career. I got very, very fortunate to take a call from a company that recognized they didn't have the infrastructure to build a communications company that they wanted. They were very good at sales and marketing. They didn't have the backbone really that we had. We could definitely benefit. We were a small, really no market. Sales and marketing was essentially me. So now to be able to take those two, you do the SWOT analysis, right? You look for the strengths and weaknesses between the two. Find out where they dovetail. That's the beauty. So we weren't tripping over one another. We knew each other's strengths. That one happened to be a Canadian communications company that ultimately it was wildly successful. It grew it to a significant portion, double digit of our total business. One partner grew to that. Now that can be a double edged sword, right? You got to be careful on that. You can't get too reliant upon one thread. But ultimately they did such a great job on their side, and we did such a great job supporting them. It was a multi-year relationship, and ultimately they were acquired for, I think $20 million, something like that. Unfortunately, I wasn't a stakeholder at the time. But anyhow,
there are plenty of opportunities for that, particularly how the world's playing out at the moment. I mean, when you've gone and sort of taken that example, you're spending time with people every day working through these kind of projects. Let's talk a little bit about Partnernomics. Mark Brigman, tell me a little bit about that person. Mark is obviously a very talented guy. What is the background of this business and the role that it plays in the ecosystem? I'm really, really fascinated by it. So let's talk a little bit about that organization.
Sure. Thanks. So yeah, Mark is impressive. He is a couple things about him that I really like, and they all exude structure. Everything that I'm really not. He's an ex-Marine. He built this program from the ground up. It's actually he did it intelligently. It's the only program that's actually been accredited by a university. and it's used in several master's programs that teach partnerships. So to me, it's fascinating to be able to bolt on to something and work with somebody like that. No, and then he also got his PhD in economics. So clearly, he is a student of the concept of business. And then he latched on to partnerships early in his career. He worked for large enterprise communication, large communications companies, and he saw that missing piece. And what he set out really to create the structure. So that to me is what I enjoy. I like being able to go into an organization and then do the assessment and say, hey, we actually have a proven framework that we can apply. Let's do the assessment, find out where you sit, where your weaknesses are, and how we help fortify them, and then, you know, and then put something in place. We can help you. It can be done for you. We'll do it for you if you want on a fractional basis. We will advise, you know, we'll go alongside and coach you along the way. Or if you want, he's built it so it can be completely self-service. There's a complete library. If somebody says, I got this, I just need a, you know, a little tips and pointers, we can do that as well. So he's done a really nice job. And then on top, he built a software that actually assesses software platform that reinforces the methodology, and it's built right on Salesforce.
You know, I love the idea of people adding that academic rigor to what's going on. So can you humor me on this? Because, you know, we both teach and we help people understand things. I actually find being an educator one of the most gratifying parts of the work that I do. Yeah. Let me run you through a framework that we use here, and you can tell me if it stacks up against what you guys do there.
Absolutely.
Let's see if this works. So I love acronyms. I love frameworks. So IDEAL is the one that I design to help my clients work through what they need to do. So IDEAL starts with obviously the letter I, and it talks about intent, which is, I think, the same approach you're talking around strategy. We want to make sure that these companies not only have a shared intent, but they have a shared language so that whenever you are talking about whatever success means, you know exactly what success means in their language. They understand it in yours. When it comes to D, it refers to dual benefit. And dual benefit is this idea that there always is going to be a primary headline metric that needs to be moved for the partnership to be successful. But there also needs to be a supporting metric to that as well. So we had this circumstance in one of my previous companies where we were working and it was as a fellow scientist, also trained but didn't practice it very much. We ended up being partners to an organization that worked in IVF and fertility. And it was the first time in my career where I found the headline metric so quickly, which was to improve the rate of successful pregnancies, right? Having children. And no one could debate or change or adjust that. And no one wanted to. It was such an important metric that the entire team, even for us who weren't involved in our day-to-day with fertility, were so deeply vested in straight away. Both teams galvanized, we moved on. Now, of course, the secondary metrics around that for them were very different. And our secondary metrics were very different as well. But having a dual benefit means that you can both serve the partnership and you can also serve the interests of the stakeholders, which I think is pretty important. Then we go to ERA or E. Now, you know, when somebody says, what's the duration of this partnership? And I do like the question, I don't love it. And I use the term ERA because for me, people who often use the turn of phrase, an end of an ERA, it's usually quite a positive sentiment, right? You've had a really good time.
Been a good run.
But you're looking at, that's right. You've had a good run and you're looking backwards from that time. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I talk about, you know, this idea of ERA, we're talking about a 2+1. In other words, we don't want to go into an annual rolling agreement. We want to go into at least 2 years with the option to extend for one. And that gives us the time to feel each other out. Most importantly, though, we want to achieve our first win within 6 months so we can actually get some runs on the board. But that's what the ERA piece is. Then we have A, which is allies. We touched on this when we've talked previously. I love the idea of the rule of five, which is that whenever you go into an organization, you have five other stakeholders apart from your primary go-to, which creates redundancy because obviously sometimes people leave organizations, but also it's good to have, I guess, a coalition of supporters who are not in your camp and you know, allow you to speak when you're not in the room, and they can advocate for you when you're not in the room so that you've got some support on the other side. And the final one is L for land. And that's about landing the first win, which has got to be in the first 6 months, ideally sooner. But it is a well-known objective that the partnership is going towards. So it can, you know, replace the trust that people on the inside of the other organization took to bring you in. So that's what we sort of get to. How have we done so far?
Very, very aligned, Phil. No shocker there, right? I think I said early on, I feel like you and I were separated at birth because we definitely have traveled. We've gotten to the same place. We've gotten taken different paths to get here.
That's it. That's it. Well, I appreciate that.
I love it.
Tell me, let's dive into some cautionary tales, because we mentioned earlier that there are, you know, a huge graveyard, both wide and deep, of partnerships that started with a great intent but never really went anywhere. And there are some which can actually be quite damaging, beyond the idea of, you know, it just didn't work. It can be quite significantly damaging. What are some of those cautionary tales that you also use in teaching to help people avoid that point of history again?
So it all comes down to, I use the word when I'm teaching these courses, and I teach a few different partnership courses, but it's all around alignment. It really, if you are out of alignment, if you are working with somebody that is going in a different direction, has a different goal, or a different customer, ideal customer, it's just not going to work. You could do great things separately, but together it's just not going to work. So I think focusing on that alignment, because, you know, everyone's talking about AI, Phil, right? AI is really huge today. To me, the original AI and partnerships, it's alignment and influence. That's the way the job gets done. You properly have the proper alignment, and then you have to be able to have the right enablement, the right onboarding, the right education and support to be able to influence the action of your partner. So they bring you deals. And then when that happens, the beauty is, we'll talk cautionary, but the beauty is when it works, my goodness, it is a thing of harmony and beauty, right? Mm-hmm. And there's your resilience, right? That's your resilient revenue, and it sustains, you know, all the storms that it needs to. So I think the first cautionary that I have is it does a lot of damage. If you rush into the partnership without a strategy, without identifying the right partners, it does two things. Number one, it's going to do internal damage. That's material. You're saying that, you know, you're going to have executives saying partners don't work. That's just not for us. We're going to go direct. Yeah. Right. So you've done that damage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then you got the external, right? You have a deal. Let's say you're working with a partner, yet you've not invested in it or whatever, for whatever reason it fell flat. That partner, they have lips. Right. And they're not afraid to use them. The problem is channel is extremely small and tight knit. Mm-hmm. So if there's a failure, it spreads like wildfire. So there's a no win. If you don't give it its due and it fails miserably, it doesn't mean they're all going to work, because they're not all going to work. But if you put in the steps on the front end to do everything you can to have that right fit, chances of failure are decreased. Chances of disaster, both internal and external, are greatly mitigated.
Yeah, I get that. And it's interesting because I think when you think about the people you originally reach out to, so in our worlds, the people that lead business development, that run the P&Ls, they understand the imperative to grow and to make all of these big decisions. And they can be small partnerships, they can also be quite large ones. Yeah. But they also understand what it takes to build relationships. And I fear often that people, we're sort of losing that skill set around how to really invest time to get to know the people on the other side, because the metrics and the short-term focus are often driving towards, I need to have this size of a funnel. It's got to be converting at this rate. We've got to have this kind of retention. And it becomes really, really difficult to then invest in the relationship. So, I mean, you've been spending a lot of your career in business development. I think people misunderstand that to be, you know, very salesy, sort of used car salesman style, but we are talking all about relationships here, right? And when you think about building those relationships so that, you know, when partnerships inevitably hit that rocky water, there has got to be, you know, calm heads will prevail, conversation can be had, risks can be addressed and mitigated. How do you think about building relationships and that underlying trust so that, you know, when you're not in the room and there is a decision to either extend or to bring to an end a partnership, that there is a trust where your opposite number or opposite number team can say, actually, no, this is working well. We are right where we need to be. This is expected, and we're going to move through this. But because we have a high level of trust with Greg and his team, how do you go about building that trust over time?
I practice this and I teach it. So I teach it and I preach it and I practice it. Don't be a vendor. You know, when you're working with partners, don't be a vendor. You know, there are dozens or hundreds of others that can do what you do from a product standpoint or from a service standpoint. And if you approach it just transactional like that, and you're just, you know, just fulfilling orders and that's it, you're just a vendor. And you are easily replaceable. To your point, Phil, you want to build that trust bank. So how do you do that? Well, you're doing it. Those other vendors, those other providers, what they don't have, this is going to sound a little fluffy, they don't have you, right? That's the only thing you can do. You can add your mark and your brand to your service. And oftentimes in channel, you know, I've been places and they'll say, they honestly would think I own the company. I never owned the company. I'm repping the company to the channel, but I treat it as though I own it because I am the face of the company. And if it fails, it's on me. Right. So I'd say that is what the way you have to approach the business. And it is truly looking for that trusted alliance that can sustain the bumps that are inevitable.
You know, it's interesting too, right? So we've talked about growth in a partnership context in terms of top line growth, but when you think of it, when we jump out of this software as a service, this software ecosystem, and we go into other harder industries, right? We talk about, you know, heavy automotive, or we talk about defense and aerospace. Yes, a lot of technology lives there, but there's a lot of physical stuff too. And that takes a lot of time to plan and build and to build those kind of relationships. And I do love the idea of looking back in time and trying to uncover almost sort of like an archaeological dig, trying to find those decisions that were made in the very early stages of a company's life to say, you know, we can't do this all ourselves. Number one, big decision. We've worked out that we can't do it all ourselves. And I know that that is the lead indicator of success for me in partnerships. But as soon as that's been made, then you have companies that have gone, well, we've got to go and find someone else who can go and do this. And at the point where there's nothing to sell, or there's technology to be built, or there's some kind of collaboration to be made, my experience is that there are many partnerships that are formed to build the bedrock of an organization in their supply chain, which goes very, very much unnoticed. And I'm interested in your point of view on this because, you know, we have had in my previous companies, we've had a situation where we've never had a marketing budget to build and, you know, go big display advertising, go big traditional media. In the same way that we haven't had the money to go and build everything ourselves. So we've required partnerships to make that work. And I've sort of developed a bit of a sense to try and find the people on the other side of, say, supply chain partners who are itching, desperate to come and want to work with their clients to build something cool. That's what they were promised in that organization. It rarely happens because nobody's coming to say, hey, listen, can we do something together? But almost at 100% strike rate, when you find those people and say, hey, listen, we don't know how to build this. Can you help? Putting aside the financial deals there before, because you don't know how much it's going to cost, the inclination for them to walk towards you and go, actually, yeah, that'd be cool. Let's go and do that, has become something quite profound. So when we think about outside of that top line growth and we go back into supply chains and other kinds of partnerships, is it the same? Are we applying a similar kind of mindset to try and build these things out? How do you think about that?
I do. I think, you know, fundamentally, there are three ways to build a business, to grow a business, right? You build, you buy, or you partner. So I've definitely, you know, dug into the partnership side of things, but there are nuances to it. So there is, you know, you've just described basically kind of what I would consider to be a technology partnership when they're building something new. Two entities together came together and built something new. Here's a prime example, right? 2007, AT&T and Apple came together and offered and created the first iPhone. Changed the entire industry. Can you imagine imagine what your day would be like? Tell you what, leave it at home tomorrow and see what your day feels like. Totally changed the space.
Probably more calm. to be honest. I think I'd be more relaxed.
poor calm, but maybe not as productive, right? No, I'm with you. Totally. And so then the other, in my mind, there are lots of different types of partnerships, but I usually break it down into three. There's the technology side, then building a new solution, then there's referral, and then reseller. Referral being a rev share. You sell something for X price, I'm going to earn a commission, a percentage based on that, a revenue share. The referral, or I'm sorry, the reseller or wholesale model, basically I'm buying at a discount, oftentimes in the SaaS space, it's like a 30% discount off of a rack. I'm buying it, bundling it, I'm layering my services on top of it, invoicing it, sending it to my customer, and that is, I make my money on that margin, the difference between the buy and the sell rate. So I really feel like those three categories cover the lion's share of the types of partnerships. Fundamentally, they all answer the question. You go through that SWOT analysis again. The aligned partner is one where they can dovetail well. There's not a lot of tripping over one another. The strengths of one is the weakness of the other. And when you find a partner that has a weakness and you at your core can fortify them in that makes for a really strong partnership. And that to me is what makes it, that's what makes it fun. I mean, it's way more fun. I'd much rather go into battle with, with an ally arm in arm versus doing it myself.
Any day, that is true. So listen, before we get into some fun rapid fire questions that sort of dive into more about, Greg Plum and his work, I'm just curious to talk about this idea of what leaders might be missing now about partnerships. So you mentioned earlier that we've all had these circumstances where it hasn't worked out well. And you're right, there is a wildfire effect. And if it was really painful and if there was risk for the person, the leader at the time who had to absorb that, then the likelihood of them walking towards this is going to be lessened every time that happens. But we are in a pretty strange time in history. There doesn't feel like a lot of things are going right around the world. And the antidote to many things is often being better together, right? Coming together and working things through, having a dialogue, doing a better job of conflict and not ignoring it, actually walking towards it. And actually, we're humans. There is conflict as part of what goes on in being human. But what are leaders missing right now? Like what is the overall upside that you think leaders are probably missing by saying, look, I hear the conceptual argument for partnerships. I get it, but you know what? It's just, it feels safer not to. What are these leaders missing?
Patience. it generally takes, and I tell always when we're having a discussion, anticipate a little bit of a build period. When I say a little bit, I'd say on average 18 months, right? You can go, it's not going to be your quickest sale, but it's certainly going to be the one with the longest tail that pays the longest dividend for the longest period of time. There's no question. Here's the other challenge. You give up a little bit of control. When you have a partner, you have to be able to collaborate effectively. You don't control everything. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to do that. And if you're partnering with somebody that augments your weakness, it's natural. Sure, I'm going to lean on this person, but we're a good partnership. I mean, think about a marriage. My wife and I are very different, but on most days we complement each other well. Like her strengths are my weaknesses. And usually that's usually it. Her strengths are my weaknesses. I can't say it the other way around. but that to me is the definition of an effective partnership. So the leaders today need to understand it's going to take time. You need to build in that. Yep. Not only that, it's not just hiring the resource. You also need to invest in the resource. You need to assume on average about 50%. If you're paying, let's say you're paying, $100,000 in salary for that resource, assume another $50,000 in different, marketing, events, support, travel, entertainment, all those different things. So there's some hidden costs that you might not be thinking about.
I really, really love that. And it's interesting too, because there is also the idea of continuous development and training and what's going on. Partnership Leaders is an organization that came out of the United States that is sort of that it feels like it's a gravitational field, right, for people who are in our fields to come together and learn from each other. And they released their annual report around the state of the union, as it were. And one of the things that was quite frightening was just how much absence of investment there is in that continuing professional development for people who are partner executives, chief partnership officers and the like, to learn more about what is changing, how is that playing out, and connecting the dots between other leaders who have seen things. So I think there is something, you know, it can feel very it can feel very investment heavy when you start to invest in a partnership's capability. But you're right, when you look at the investment, if you can have that patience and just hold fire with the short termism, I think you end up with some pretty fantastic outcomes.
100%.
You know, Greg, this has been a really fun conversation, and I do love ending on a rapid fire. So I know you've seen these questions.
I forget. I did, but I forget them. So I'm going in cold, but that's okay. Let's do it.
Perfect. All right. So let's bring this home. This is always good fun. So complete this sentence. Partnership is
the lifeblood of any business.
Love it. What content are you loving at the moment? Could be books, could be podcasts. Of course, you can say Partnership Plus. We can edit that out.
I love Partnership Plus. Phil, you have no idea. This has been refreshing getting to know you. I thoroughly enjoy this and expect us to collaborate plenty going forward. So this has definitely been fun. Content that I've been loving, you know, it's oldie but a good. Seth Godin. He's just amazing. I get I look at his blog post every morning. It's one of the first things I read in the morning. He's just great, you know, and some of it's just like common sense, and he's a little tongue in cheek, you know, takes his zingers every now and again. I really enjoy his point of view. As far as something a little more substantial, Give and Take by Adam Grant. Great book. Givers, takers, and matchers. Fantastic. Talks about the different, love it. I mean, I didn't realize what I was until I was labeled a giver, and it's cool. I was like, oh, I guess I've been doing it right. You know, it's kind of the basis of, I do a lot of volunteering, and I do it not to be altruistic. I do it because I feel good when I do it. You know, it makes me, it's almost, I feel selfish. But I didn't realize that there was somehow deep in me, there is a selfish side or an altruistic side to it. But anyway, he really does a nice job and makes you understand. If you give to get something in return, and that's how most people operate. And I've been there. I've been in that mindset. When you do that and you succeed, what happens? You get exactly what you're setting out for. If you give just to give, it just comes back, you know, many times over. It's way more rewarding that way.
Many, many times over. That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. So what's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I was told when I was younger that I was horrible. I was one of the most difficult employees because I was too headstrong and I felt like I could do everything on my own. And it really stung. It really stung. My ego was hurt. I was young. I was really young. But it stuck with me for a long time. And it made me realize, yeah, there's a time when, even if I think I could do it, I think I could do it better, there's a time to just be quiet, take it all in. And if I get my time to add my value, great. If not, that's okay too.
I hear you on that. I think I've received similar feedback. Probably not only once either. I think it's been a couple of times. That's excellent. All right. So when you see a potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
I sit down and I actually do a little bit of a discovery, and I look for that alignment. We sit down, and then if there is alignment, it looks like we have a fit. The next step is really look at the next 90 days. What can we do together in the next 90 days? It's the crawl, walk, run mentality. That's how you get that first win, and that's how you buy the loyalty. That's where it all starts, and it keeps that thing from happening where you were talking about earlier. You get the signed paper, and then here you are 6-12 months later, nothing's happening. It eliminates that.
I love that. Okay, final question. What's the one thing you're deeply grateful for right now? And when I ask this question, a lot of people go, I only get one. So look, I'll give you three. We've got to change this question up a little bit, but one, two, or three. What are you deeply grateful for?
I'll do two. I'll do professionally and I'll do personally.
Perfect.
I'll start professionally. Professionally, I am grateful for to get a voice, to get an opportunity to share my passion. All too often, you know, you're stuck in a situation where you don't get a voice and you may feel something strongly and you don't get the opportunity to share that. I've been blessed, mm-hmm. really, really lucky. And a lot of this comes through volunteerism. It's given me a voice that I probably, and a seat at a table I probably didn't deserve. But I took it and really got everything I could out of it and enjoyed it every step of the way. And because of that, it kind of builds upon itself, which leads to conversations just like this, Phil. Personally, I'm filled with gratitude. I'm at the age right now where my kids are coming into the room. My son has his first career job. He's a data scientist. My daughter is chemical engineering. They found their own ways. We didn't say, hey, go do this. This is what you should be looking at. And I had no idea what they would do, but they're kind of finding their way on their own and they are contributing humans, and positive individuals in the world. That's a beautiful thing. And I will give most of the credit to my wife because she certainly deserves it. But that to me, I'm grateful. When I sit back with a glass of bourbon, that's what I think about.
You know what? Parenting is a journey. We've got two girls, and I'm a very proud and quite loud girl dad. In case you're wondering, this is what a feminist looks like. So you know, when we are thinking and reflecting on the journey that is parenting, which is not all beer and Skittles. There is a lot of goodness to look back on. So congratulations for that. Before we close out, we know that PartnerOmix is a really terrific organization in the States. I understand that for people listening, there might be an opportunity to engage in some of the education material that you've got. So let's talk briefly about that because I know anyone who is interested in this field can benefit from that kind of work. So what is on offer there, Greg?
Yep, thanks, Phil. So we touched on it briefly. So PartnerOmix has three legs. There's the content, right? There's coursework that you can go self-serve where you can learn the basics of partnering. There is a guided, almost like a coaching where we can ride alongside and have weekly sessions to just augment the learning. And then there is a fractional where we can step in as a part of that, a part of the whole organization to help drive partnerships. But the freebie, mm-hmm. right, the giveaway here is actually we have our foundations course. And by the way, all of the coursework, it's the only university-backed partnering program in the world. So that to me, I think I shared that earlier because I'm kind of proud of it. I didn't do it, but I didn't get that accreditation, but I'm proud of it because it is unique. But you know, anybody that's listening to this can go out. I'm sure we'll drop the link in where they can sign up for it's. I think it's a retail value of $500, which is a bargain, but it's 3 hours, I believe 3 hours of content for free, where you can go out your own pace. You even get the university certification on partnering foundations, and you can use that badge at will. So
fantastic.
Have at it. Yep.
That's great. And Greg, if people wanted to reach out to you and to be in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, of course, LinkedIn. So yeah, it's really easy to find me on LinkedIn, just Greg Plum. You'll see, it's funny there, you'll see the banner of one of the TEDx talks. So thanks for that shout out too. So yeah, TEDx has definitely been a big part of my career, my journey. And I could not more highly recommend doing a talk if you get the opportunity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I really enjoyed doing mine. So listen, Greg Plum, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time. And we'll look forward to our next one.
Absolutely, Phil. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.